Chapter 28. Vindicated. September 568 BC. Amasis arrived in Tarpanese as expected, but it was a very low-key arrival. Normally, when Pharaoh visited, prior notice was given so that the local authorities could ensure an appropriate welcome. But not this time. No crowds lined the broad avenues, and at one intersection, Pharaoh's cavalcade even had to pause while a large cart pulled by a long line of leisurely oxen made its way over the crossroad. By chance, I saw him arrive at the palace. It may seem silly, but I had returned to look at the pavement outside the palace and pray. Over the years, the appearance of open spaces gradually changes, even those that are not actively renovated or remodelled. Extra murals may be added, or faded ones painted over. Decorative statues are added, moved, or removed. Torch mountings are modified. They may be small things, but they all subtly change the overall appearance. As I studied the pavement leading to the palace doors, I tried once again to work out exactly where I had enacted the parable I was hoping to see fulfilled. After a while, and a deal of prayer, I felt that I had the location worked out quite accurately, exactly halfway between two torch mountings on the wall, mountings that had not been there at the time. Having located the place, I crossed to it and stood a while, turning my mind once more to prayer. My request to Yahweh was that his prediction would have its fulfillment very soon. Nobody nearby could have had any idea that I was praying, but perhaps I looked distracted.
"Time to go home for a rest, old man," said a sudden, gentle but businesslike voice in my ear.
I felt a hand under my elbow with a gentle pressure to suggest where I should move. I started in surprise, turning to look at him and stuttering a bit as I answered, I'm sorry, I was deep in prayer."
"Prayer, was it?"
The man looked a little apologetic.
"I thought you might be. But never mind, Pharaoh has just arrived. See, here he is, coming along the pavement. I need you to give him space."
He clearly thought that I was either senile or drunk, but as I began to object, I followed the direction of his gesturing arm and saw Amasis walking right towards me.
"Jeremio,"
he greeted me, his voice the most subdued I had ever heard it. The attentive servant who had tried to move me on bobbed his head at Amasis and stepped back, leaving us to talk.
"Greetings, Amasis," I answered. "You're here to meet Nebuchadnezzar?"
"Shush, shush," he said, looking around quickly. "I am, but we are trying to keep it fairly quiet."
I was struggling to understand what he said. I was tired, and I'm finding Egyptian harder and harder to understand. Hebrew is still easy, but I'm losing the other languages I once knew. Amasis saw my expression and repeated his words in Hebrew. I smiled my thanks and replied, without considering that I was addressing Pharaoh, "I don't think you'll be able to keep it quiet, my friend."
"Friend, you say, Jeremio? Yes, you are my friend. But I think that's the first time anyone has genuinely called me friend since I became Pharaoh."
"I've known many kings to a greater or lesser extent, Amasis, but you are the only one I would call a friend."
"Have you met Nebuchadnezzar?"
"Yes, twice, but only briefly."
"What is he like?"
"Proud, ingenious, and very intense. A brilliant general, too."
"That fits with what I hear. On a professional level, I would love to meet him in battle."
His eyes lit up. My dismay must have been obvious, for he held up a hand and said,
"Don't worry, Jeremio. I'll try to avoid it."
"If you fight, Egypt will lose," I said.
"Egypt was great before Nebuchadnezzar came along, and she will be great long after he is gone."
"She will only be great if you listen to the words of Yahweh."
Well, I don't have any more time to talk now,
Amasis said dismissively. Then he looked more closely at me and added,
You should go home and rest, Jeremio. You don't look very well.
I am a bit tired, I admitted. I'm getting older. When is Nebuchadnezzar coming? Amasis looked around carefully. There were few people near us, and none looked even vaguely interested in what we were saying. Presumably they couldn't understand Hebrew. Nevertheless, Amasis leaned towards me and spoke quietly.
Tomorrow afternoon, I believe. But don't tell anyone. I want to get through this with as little fanfare as possible.
I don't like your chances, I answered wearily. I told you what Nebuchadnezzar is like.
I'll do my best anyway.
I went home and collapsed into bed and slept until morning. For some reason, I've been very tired for the last few days, so I've taken the opportunity to bring this diary right up to date. Several times recently, Baruch has offered to write it for me, but I still feel the need to write it myself. I don't think I could organize my thoughts enough to dictate it. I felt better in the morning and told Baruch as much as I could about the previous day's events. You should come with me to the palace this afternoon, I said.
When?
I don't know exactly. I was planning to go early and stay there until the action finishes.
What action?
You have heard that Nebuchadnezzar is coming?
Yes.
Then take your best guess. I can't say anything more. I think Amasis asked me not to. Baruch looked at me with furrowed brows. I wasn't completely sure what had happened, and thinking about it was making me tired again, so I stopped. This afternoon was important, and I had to get to the palace to watch the show. I've waited a long time for this.
How about I go to the palace and see what is happening?
Offered Baruch.
I'll find out when everything is ready to go and come back and fetch you. Do you think you can walk that far?
Walk that far? I scoffed. Of course! So now I'm sitting here waiting for Baruch to come back. He's a good friend and has been a great help to me over the years. He's not so young himself, but he's still a hard worker. All those letters he's written for me in that neat handwriting of his. If only I had been blessed with such a skill. Baruch has written out all of my messages from God, and recently he's been on at me to order them for him. But how should they be arranged? If I put them in the order God gave them, there will be lots and lots of repetition. I've already arranged them so that there isn't much repetition, but Baruch would like to go through and remove even the repetition that's left. He tells me he's already done a rough copy of it, but he won't show me until it's ready. I still have that box of scrolls that we brought from Judah, too, but I've always been too busy to get them organized. There are lots of short scrolls and some longer ones, too, but most of those aren't in the right order. I've always made sure to write down God's messages, but sometimes the latest scroll wasn't available where I was, and so I wrote a new message at the end of an older scroll. I should explain to Baruch the code I used to write the dates for each entry. At least if he knew that, he could put them in order better. I don't know. It's too hard today. I'm tired and excited, if one can be both at the same time. Perhaps I can get back to it tomorrow. Amasis may have hoped to keep Nebuchadnezzar's visit low-key, but Nebuchadnezzar didn't cooperate. As he approached Tarpanes, his army continued to burn, pillage, and collect captives. True, the wanton destruction had been more widespread in Upper Egypt, where more resistance had been shown, but the Chaldean army left its mark on Lower Egypt too. Many of their targets were the temples in which the Egyptians worshipped their multitude of deities. Nebuchadnezzar demolished and burned many of these, often triggering a violent response from disgruntled worshippers. The Chaldeans seemed almost to welcome these confrontations, which gave them good reason to litter Egypt's sand with more corpses and to lead away yet more captives in Nebuchadnezzar's train. As a result, ever-growing lines of chained and humiliated Egyptians stumbled sullenly along behind the Chaldean army. Amasis didn't seem to care much about the assaults on Egypt's temples, though, despite the fact that he had renovated several of them earlier in his reign. Obelisks are scattered throughout the land as common celebrations of Egypt's greatness, and Nebuchadnezzar's men threw many of them to the ground, shattering them, just as God had said he would. Sadly, I find that I can no longer remember God's exact words. In the morning, news came that Nebuchadnezzar's army was almost at the gates of Tarpanese, and that the land behind it looked like a charred wilderness. I began to wonder if Amasis would succeed in retaining his position as pharaoh. After all, he was allowing Nebuchadnezzar to wreak widespread suffering and destruction without resistance. Official resistance, that is. I had heard various rumours of confrontations where the resisting forces seemed surprisingly well equipped, despite their limited size, and used strike-and-run tactics that seemed to me to bear the hallmarks of Amasis's leadership. Perhaps, despite everything he was indulging, in a stealthy, limited way, his desire to test his mettle against Nebuchadnezzar. Amasis can be a bit of a puzzle at times. Nevertheless, Nebuchadnezzar wanted a royal welcome at the gates of Tarpanese, and Amasis had no choice but to accede to his demand. Despite a night's rest, I still felt exhausted and even a little muddled. When Baruch offered to watch the morning's events and report back, leaving me to rest at home, I accepted gratefully. We agreed that if he had not returned by about noon, I would go to Pharaoh's palace to see what was happening. So Baruch departed, and I rested on my bed, still working to get this diary completely up to date. I also slept. As a result, I was not present at the gates when Nebuchadnezzar's approaching army spread out and encircled the city. It was a show of force that left no question as to who was in control. Amasis welcomed Nebuchadnezzar at the gate, attended by nothing more than a guard of honour. Had Nebuchadnezzar chosen to openly humiliate, imprison, or kill him, the guard would have been no protection at all. Yet Amasis welcomed Nebuchadnezzar graciously, and the Chaldean empire builder treated him with equal grace and politeness in return. Baruch returned a little before midday to report all of this, arriving just as I was preparing to struggle out to the palace. Already I wondered how I was going to endure hours of standing. I felt weak and shaky, but I couldn't resist the attraction of seeing an expected fulfillment of prophecy. Baruch observed that although Amasis had delivered a short speech of welcome, he had not been very well, coughing frequently and speaking gruffly, in little more than a whisper. I may be unjust, but I couldn't help wondering whether the cough might be a convenient way of making sure that few people heard Pharaoh's words acknowledging Nebuchadnezzar as his master. After all, I had seen no sign of any cough when I spoke with Amasis the previous day. "We should go to the palace," I said wearily to Baruch after a while. I struggled to stand up and grabbed quickly at the doorpost to steady myself. "I need to watch Nebuchadnezzar's presentation at the palace."
"Don't worry, Jeremiah. It's not happening today. You can sit down again. Or would you rather lie down?"
Without waiting for an answer, he helped me over to my bed and I sank onto it. "Why isn't it happening?" I asked, concerned.
"Amasis's steward began to announce that King Nebuchadnezzar would be presented to the people at the palace this afternoon, but Nebuchadnezzar waved him to silence and called Amasis over, much as one might summon a young child or a junior servant. After a while it was announced that Nebuchadnezzar would be presented tomorrow morning instead. I don't know what the hold-up was, but Amasis didn't look very happy."
Perhaps Nebuchadnezzar has planned a different presentation from what Amasis wanted, I guessed.
You could be right, agreed Baruch. But whatever the reason, you can rest again this afternoon. Perhaps you'll feel better tomorrow morning.
After resting all afternoon, I felt a little better. Baruch prepared our evening meal, and I ate my share to keep him happy. But it seemed like hard work. Although I felt tired, I also felt like reminiscing. "Remember when you went to read all of my prophecies to the people in the temple?" I asked.
"Yes. I expected it to be a simple job, but it ended up a terrifying day."
Hiding behind a small screen in a dark, locked room while they searched every other room in the temple, at last making their way to ours. Is that how you remember it?
Exactly so. When they finally brought the key and opened the door, I was almost sure they'd find us.
But they didn't. God really cared for us that day, didn't he?
And he's cared for us ever since, too. So many of our family members and acquaintances have died, but we keep on living, marveled Baruch.
And now most of those who dragged us down to Egypt, where they thought they'd be safe, have died at the hand of Nebuchadnezzar and his men. They thought they could avoid God's judgment, but no one can do that. I sighed, wishing that reminiscing could bring happy memories rather than the memories of terror on every side that have filled my service to Yahweh. Perhaps Baruch sensed my sadness and overpowering desire for happy reflections, for he said suddenly, "Wasn't Ebed-Melech a good example of trusting God? A foreigner, but so faithful." And so grateful when Yahweh promised to keep him safe through the destruction of Jerusalem. There was no doubt that he believed it completely. His faith was inspiring.
Yet God's own people wouldn't believe.
They considered Yahweh as helpless as the gods they claimed to worship. That day when I called our people together to watch me bury those stones under Pharaoh's pavement, I remember one of them said I'd been wrong with all my prophecies. He sneered at me.
Was that Rapha the Lazy?
Yes, I think it was, I said cautiously.
Well, guess who I met at the gate today?
Rapha, you mean?
Yes.
But he left Tarpanese years ago.
True. Apparently he went upstream. This morning he told me he was in Memphis when Nebuchadnezzar attacked. What he saw reminded him of the Valley of Slaughter.
The Valley of Ben-Hinnom, you mean?
Yes, that's how much gruesome butchery there was.
Yet he survived?
Somehow, yes. He sounded quite bitter at times, but at other times he just sounded resigned. He said most of the Jews he knew in Memphis had been killed, and the reports from further up the river were just as bad.
So why did he come to Tarpanese?
I asked him the same thing, but he said he'd tell me tomorrow. He was asking about you, too. He assumed that you'd be dead by this time, and seemed glad to hear that you weren't.
Glad? He must have thought up some new words of abuse to throw at me. Did I sound bitter or resigned?
Perhaps. But he looks quite different. For a start, he's lost a lot of weight. I didn't recognize him until he introduced himself.
Well, I suppose I'll have to see him tomorrow and find out what he blames me for now. You know, Baruch, this work as Yahweh's prophet doesn't get any easier with time. After a good night's sleep, I felt much better, better than I had felt for some time. I even woke early enough to indulge my lifelong love of watching the sun rise. Leaving my bed, I went outside and climbed the ladder up to the roof. It was still cold, and the blackness of night had only just begun to lift.
Sitting on the parapet, I revelled in the beauty of the clear, star-filled sky as the nearly full moon set in the west, departing almost as if to leave the sky clear, ready for the sun to fill it with splendour in an hour or so. I guessed that tonight would be a full moon, and thought of Moses and Aaron leading the Israelites out of Egypt under a full moon so many centuries earlier. A generation of slaves experienced new life as Yahweh gave the gift of freedom to his people. Yet now God's people have been driven into captivity out of their promised land because they rejected Yahweh, the God who led them out of Egypt. Many returned to Egypt, and most of these have died in this foreign land. I wondered when my own time in Egypt would come to an end. It wasn't a morbid thought. I do not seek death, but am content that God's work for me is probably nearly finished. Today I hope to see something I have waited many years to see, but in the meantime I rejoiced in the beauty of another dawn, the first I have seen for some time. Slowly the sky in the east lightened, and the dimmer stars began to flicker out. From the point on the horizon at which the sun would soon edge its way into view, a band of deep grey light spread slowly around the horizon in both directions until it met in the west, completely encircling the sky. A dark red glow followed, slowly swelling in the east and transforming the greyness. I can't properly describe just how deep a red it was. It was as if an enormous blaze in the heavens had extinguished itself, its fading embers dying moments before, leaving only the faintest echo of their last glimmers. This indescribable red glow steadily filled almost half the sky, its deep melancholy achingly beautiful. I longed to share this moment with someone, but as usual I was alone, except for the presence of God. It was a time to relax in the strong, loving arms of my Maker, who has always caught me when I fall, strengthened me when I need it, and taught me whenever I will listen. The ever-growing light of sunrise gave me strength, and I felt the intense closeness to Yahweh that I have felt on several occasions during my inexpressibly privileged life. By the time I descended the stairs in the full light of day, I was content. In the house, I found that Baruch had recently risen and was about to go out in search of me. I described the sunrise to him, and he suggested that I include a description in my diary. When I read the description now, it feels feeble and inadequate, hopelessly incomplete and lacking in beauty. But that is always the way when humans attempt to describe God's handiwork. Amasis was to present Nebuchadnezzar to the Egyptians that morning at the entrance to Pharaoh's palace. I was eager to watch everything that might happen, but Baruch suggested that I husband my strength and wait until the presentation was about to begin. Dissatisfied, but wise enough to accept that he was right, I remained at home, getting this diary completely up to date. Not only is my writing very untidy, as it has been all my life, it is now also the spidery writing of the old, jagged edges everywhere. Still waiting. Finally, the news has come that preparations for the royal presentation are complete. Nebuchadnezzar's men are making their way through the city with Amasis's men, encouraging Egypt's citizens to come and see their conqueror. I don't think Amasis will be very pleased, but I hope he'll accept that he can do nothing but indulge Nebuchadnezzar's rampant self-promotion. Baruch has finally agreed that it is time to leave for the palace.